I love digging in the dirt with just a pick and brush. Finding fossils is my aim, so I'm never in a rush, 'cause the treasures that I seek are rare and ancient things, like Velociraptor's jaw or Archaeopteryx's wings. Now all the kids who want to see them are lining up at the museum. I am a paleontologist. Crushing plants with rounded teeth, or ferocious carnivore who moves so quickly on its feet. It's like pieces of a puzzle that I love to try and solve. It's so fun to think about how a species has evolved. And all the kids who want to see them can check them out at our museum. I am a paleontologist. That's who I am, that's who I am.
Cephalosaurus?
I am a paleontologist. That's who I am, that's who I am, that's who I am. I am a paleontologist. That's who I am, that's who I am, that's who I am. That's who I am, that's who I am, that's who I am. That's who I am, that's who I am, that's who I am.
And welcome back. This is Radio Freethinker, the show that promotes skeptical thinking and science and reasoning and all that fun stuff. As you can tell,
we're absent our normal lead guy, Ethan, who is apparently somewhere dead or dying in the gutter somewhere.
He's lying in a quick recovery.
Toronto gave him diseases.
That's right. Ethan and Daniel, who is sitting in the engineer's chair today.
I apologize for anything I screw up.
And for those who don't know, this is Don, the philosopher, political science guy.
And this is Rob, cognitive psychologist, and also coming out of a cold.
And this is Daniel, the guy pressing buttons.
So you had a fun time there in Toronto, eh?
Yeah, other than the lack of sleep and fighting a cold pretty much the entire time, I had a good time.
You were there for the CFI?
The first ever CFI Canada conference. In the past, they've only done the CFI Transnational Conference, which is basically more or less the American one. But now that CFI Canada is a registered charity and you can vote tax exempt, or vote, you can give the money tax exempt, they had enough to do their own conference. So it was a good success for a first.
Sounds cool. Now, I know we've got some interviews and some stuff coming from your conference, but overall, can you give us a general thing about what was happening there? And
There was sort of two parts to it. There was one aimed at student leaders and organizers across the country, and I won't go too much into this because I don't want to bore our listeners with like organizational stuff, but it was useful for people like me who are on the executive for a campus club, and Ethan, who is the executive director of CFI Vancouver.
So was that where they taught you how to be a fifth columnist? And because we all know that, you know, liberals are and people who are skeptics are out to destroy the system. And did you learn how to make a bomb there while you were there?
No.
We learned do that on the internet if you really
want. Yeah, we learned how to raise money and run events that are popular.
Speaking of raising money and popular events, how'd you like that segue?
Good segue.
Last year, we had our listeners donating to CITR as part of their annual fund drive. And this week is the Donator Appreciation Week. So every show this week is going to play a list of the names of the people who donated and anything that they recorded for the station. So here's right now our list of donators. Thank you very much.
Thank you to the following 2009 CITR Fund Drive donors who donated during Radio Free Thinkers. Thank you Paula, Gordon, Fred, Elon, Rob, Ryan, Marlene, and Louise.
All right. Thank you to all those people for donating.
Yeah, it was quite good that not only did your donations help the station and help public radio,
but they finally got rid of Ethan.
Hey-o! Oh.
He's probably listening live, actually.
As opposed to Ethan, who's doing that. Elon, never mind. Hey, nice day out.
Everything falls apart without...
So speaking of the CFI conference and all the wonderful stuff you got there, maybe we should start off with one of your interviews and then we'll intersperse some of the news items that we've got to normally bring in the show.
Sure. We'll start off with an interview with Pam Walls, who is basically Ethan for the East Coast.
So I'm here at the CFI National Conference with...
Pam Walls.
And what do you do, Pam?
I'm the director of CFI Ontario.
So you're my East Coast equivalent, basically.
Yep, exactly, pretty much.
Well, I guess actually I'm your West Coast equivalent because you were hired first. You've been here for how long?
Almost 6 months, yeah.
So you have a pretty good opinion of Justin Trottier, our director of CFI Canada, who's not around, so you can say anything you want about Justin.
You might hear this somewhere, so you never know. Yeah. No, he's awesome. He's great. He's a real leader in the free thought movement, and it's amazing working with him. Yeah.
Very well said. So you actually were one of the main organizers of this conference. So from the very beginning, how do you think it went down?
Oh, man, it was a lot of work. It was a lot of work. When I first got hired back in October, they were planning on having it at the end of October. And so I was kind of thrown into the middle of planning this huge conference in a couple of weeks. And so thankfully, we actually postponed it till March. And so I had that time to really think about how I wanted to do it and how all the preparation that was needed. So I have been working on this for months. So the little tiniest detail I had a hand in. So it was a lot of work, but everything went really smoothly, which was really nice. There were no big bumps in the road at all. And yeah, it went really well.
Excellent. Speaking as both a participant and a speaker, I think everybody seemed to enjoy themselves and have a very good time. And, you know, maybe this says something about the skeptical movement in Canada, that we can, you know, hold our own, that we can have our own type of conference. And maybe this could be something that happens every year. What do you think of that?
Oh, absolutely. Like, we're... You know, it was our very first one, and it went so well, and we're learning so much by, you know, just going through it and learning. And it's just going to keep getting bigger and better, and I think it's just wonderful.
So how about you? How did you personally get involved in the skeptical movement? Was there anything, one thing that, you know, kind of pushed you into it, or were you always sort of skeptical?
Well, I grew up in Calgary in a religious family, and so I was... You know, I grew up in that kind of environment. And it wasn't really one thing that made me kind of question everything. It was more of a gradual questioning all the time. Like, yeah, I just didn't really buy into it from the very beginning. So it was just kind of a gradual letting go of faith that that I kind of went through. And so it wasn't a big, huge moment in my life that I had, like, a breakthrough or anything like that. I've always been a critical thinker and very analytical and always question authority and, you know, what's being said to me. So that's kind of how I got thinking about all these sorts of things. And then when I went to Ghana in university for a credit travel program, I was really interested in just religion and why people think the way they do and the effect it has on development, the development of minds, the development of countries, and all these sorts of things. And so when I went there, I did a research paper on Christianity's effect on the education system, and that's really what got me really thinking about it and writing about it. And so when I came back to Canada, I just really kept reading a lot more, reading Dawkins, listening to lectures, and getting more and more into it. And I started a blog over a year and a half ago, just writing about these ideas as well. So that's kind of how I got into just secularism, the skepticism, humanism, all these sorts of things. And so because of that, that was one of the reasons I got hired as the director of CFI Ontario.
And you mentioned your blog. Can our listeners check that blog out sometime?
It's pretty much defunct now. It's definitely on hiatus.
But they can still go back and read some of your
older posts? Yeah, all the posts are still there. They can go back and read it. It's just pamwalls.blogspot.com if they want to read it.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure they'll check it out.
Well, we just started a new blog with CFI Canada that I'm going to be contributing to there. And my blog is called Words of Disbelief, and that's on the CFI Canada website. So
definitely want our listeners to check out that blog. So being the executive director of CFI here in Ontario, what would you say are Ontario's big skeptical battlegrounds?
Big skeptical battlegrounds. I would say there are quite a few different things. One of the big things I would say that we're focusing on, especially with the Committee for the Advancement of Scientific Skepticism cast on the committees we have here, is homeopathy and alternative medicine. That's kind of been on our radar. It's kind of mostly on our radar all the time. And it seems to be not a huge issue, but definitely something that's always kind of in the paper, always kind of something on the blogs and going on. So that's something we usually address.
Yeah, that's pretty much Vancouver's biggest problem, as well as alternative medicine, which I'm sure our listeners know I've mentioned many times. So of all the talks that we had over the conference, what was your favorite? What really spoke to you?
There are quite a few really good ones. I think I liked the whole panel on kind of ethics and morals and atheism, and showing that how you can be a moral being without God. I thought that was really interesting. That was Byron, I think it was Byron Williston's presentation. Was really, really well done.
Excellent. And is that something that you've sort of been interested in for a long time, the sort of the question of how can you be good without God?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Like, as I said, I grew up, you know, in a Catholic religious family, and basically you were good because if you were bad, then you were going to hell. God was going to punish you, and that's basically the only reason. Well, not the only reason, but I thought, you know, well, you're only good because God tells you to, and that's what you're supposed to do. And so ever since I let go of God, I've been kind of thinking about, well, I'm still a good person. Why am I still a good person? Why do we think we need to have that authority figure looking down on you and watching you all the time to make sure you're good? You're just good to other people because you're good to other people. We're all part of the same family, and we're all in this together. So you don't need that babysitter up there spying on you all the time to make sure you're going to be good to each other.
Yeah, well said. So what's on the radar for CFI here in Toronto and Ontario? Is there any things you can hint at, maybe, or secrets you could okay. Let loose?
Well, we're going to be announcing probably at the AGM this afternoon. We're going to be focusing on our 2010 campaign, and we have several ideas we're kind of kicking around. But they're definitely going to focus more on the skeptical side of things rather than just focusing on secularism or religion. We're going to maybe focus more on skepticism this year, because last year, you know, we had the Atheist Bus campaign, and that was a huge success. So we might focus more on skeptical issues in a big way, in almost as like on the same scale as the Atheist Bus campaign. So that's going to be really exciting. I won't go into details of our slogan or anything like that, but it's going to be pretty cool. And alongside that, we're going to have lecture series and film screenings and all those sorts of things. So that's going to be really exciting this year.
Well, excellent. And I guess on that good note, we will say goodbye to Pam, and thanks for talking to us on Radio Free Thinker.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
And welcome back to Radio Freethinker. That was an interview that Ethan did with Pam Walls at the CFI National Conference. And you're just talking about issues of secularism and religion at the end there. And a couple of cool scientific studies that I came across this week were tangentially related. One of them was from the blog Epiphenom, which is written by Tom Rees, and he does a lot of he basically reports on and reviews a lot of really cool research into religion and atheism and psychology and neuroscience. And one that he found was this researcher called V. Saraglu did a meta-analysis of 63 older studies on personality and religion. It was published in Personality and Social Psychology Review. And basically, there's this model of personality called the Big Five, which people have done some analyses, statistical analyses of how people rate on personality tests, and found that pretty much all of it can be broken down to ratings on five different dimensions: neuroticism, agreeableness, extroversion, conscientiousness, and openness. And what this review found, the main finding, was that across all measures of religiosity and controlling for cultural, social area and age, things like that, increased agreeableness and conscientiousness were associated with increased religiosity. And so the thing that caught me about this, the headline from Epiphenom, was atheists are less agreeable and less conscientious. And I was like, hold on a second. So basically, as a sort of definition of these terms, agreeableness is how I guess likely you are to go along with what other people are doing, and conscientiousness is how much you plan things in advance and think about the consequences of things.
Just off the top of my head, but I have to say I disagree with you. sorry, a pun, you know,
point
agreeable
proven.
So
I thought this was pretty interesting, that religiosity is associated with increased agreeableness and conscientiousness, sort of more planning ahead and more likely to go along with what other people want to do. And the blog post goes into more detail on this, and the review also finds differences between European and American, basically differences in religiosity between the cultures and how correlated they are with these five personality factors. The main point was that in Europe, religiosity is associated with being less agreeable and less open.
Open in what way?
Openness is how likely you are to try new things or be open to new outside beliefs and things like that. And so, sort of looking at this, and the way that he goes into it is that this has to do with how mainstream religiosity is within your culture. So the idea is that in America, in the U.S. especially, religiosity is such a mainstream thing that when you're an agreeable and conscientious person, where you plan ahead, look at the consequences of your actions, and you're likely to go along with what's popular and what other people are doing, you're going to tend to be more religious. Whereas in Europe, religiosity isn't that mainstream in their social culture. So you have to be someone who wants to go against the grain in order to be more religious. So the thing that sort of struck me about this is that how dependent on context religiosity is. Like, your personality will predict whether you're religious or not, but not in the absence of the context. It's going to depend on how religion is viewed socially and wherever you are.
You mentioned Europe there. Actually, I find one of the interesting dichotomies in Europe is you think of some of the biggest atheist countries, something like Sweden or Norway or whatever, and they are culturally atheist, but they're also highly church. If you look at the levels of church, because the church has evolved from a religious institution to a cultural institution, and that, again, applies the context to which these questions are even asked. I mean, like I say, if you go to Norway, you say, you know, do you believe in God? They'll say no. You say, do you go to church? They'll say, of course. You know, and it's like, you know, where how do you split that?
Because it's turned into sort of a more social and cultural institution rather than a strongly held belief, I guess.
Exactly. I mean, how can you be British and not Anglican? You know.
But the thing to note about this study is that atheism wasn't specifically investigated, because all these ratings put religiosity on a continuum of, like, low religiosity to high religiosity, and so atheist tendencies were basically mixed up with the low religiosity on the scale.
Cool.
Another story that more people may have heard of is that Sam Harris,
famous for his End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation,
and
also noted is he a neurologist or a neuroscientist?
Neuroscientist covers neurology, so okay. Let's say that. So Sam Harris, in collaboration with Jonas Kaplan, did a fMRI study at UCLA. And fMRI, again, is the functional magnetic resonance imaging. It's a brain scan of what your brain is doing in real time. And what he did is they got 15 devout Christians and 15 non-believers and had them rate the truth or falsity of a number of religious and non-religious statements while doing fMRI scans of their brains. And they found...
Let me guess. That the religious people were always lying and the non-religious people were always good because we know it's that. No?
Not quite. Actually, the interesting finding here, given that most people assume that religious faith is a different kind of belief, that it's a belief in something with less evidence but very strongly held, and he found that there's no significant differences in the brain scans of religious thought and faith versus non-religious.
So does this sort of... on the one hand, it weakens some what I would call Dawkian atheist views about this real bad thing about religion, and it's somehow different. But conversely, it also weakens the argument for those people who say there are two kinds of knowing. You can know something scientifically, and you can know something spiritually. And this kind of says, no, they're the same kind of knowing. You should not treat religious belief any different than you would any other belief, because at least as far as we know so far in the brain, they are the same thing.
Yeah, at the very least, no matter what you believe, it's represented in pretty much the exact same way in your brain.
I have to say, we might be jumping a little bit here when this is one study with 15 or 30 people.
I haven't actually read the study. I know, my bad. But I'm assuming that they had enough power for it to be statistically significant.
But Daniel does point out, it's a single study, although there have been other studies into this area. Although, actually, I always thought that they found a God place in the brain. That was
There is a place in the brain that is associated with feelings of connectedness with the universe. They call it the God spot, but it's more of like when you're stimulated there by transcranial magnetic stimulation or the magic wand, as neuroscience people call it. That you feel sort of a sense of euphoria and connectedness with the being of the universe or something like that.
So this study...
It's not necessarily religious belief so much as a religious spiritual feeling.
So this study dealt with the rationality of the context of the words. How do we deal with the words? Versus the other ones, the God spot, which has nothing to do with the words and just deals with the emotion of it.
Roughly. But the results of the study led Harris to make a nice little quote here. Believing the sun is a star is rather the same as believing Jesus was born of a virgin.
Cool. There's one thing I'm going to point out here. Some people will hear the name Sam Harrison as one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse. And just to lay out that there is a lot of debate in the atheist community, me being probably the most virulent atheist on the cast here. And some people like Sam Harris and Christopher Hitchens have been sidelined for their other political beliefs, as far as their belief in war and racism and all that kind of thing. But this is a pure science study, peer-reviewed, I assume, even though you did trash peer-reviewed, didn't you, in our previous episode?
It wasn't so much trashing as saying...
As point out that there are problems with the way it's currently done.
Right.
It's not the be-all, end-all of everything.
I guess my point is that we shouldn't use an ad hominem attack for those people who may who know the name and may have a strong negative feeling, saying, oh, well, this is obviously why they came up with that.
No,
that's one of the great joys of a science versus opinion or what have you.
I don't know if any of you other guys have seen this, but there's a thing going on right now with Daniel Loxton, who is sort of a local atheist skeptic from Victoria or on the island somewhere. He just published a book called Evolution.
Simply Evolution?
No, it had a subtitle. Okay. I can't remember it. But basically there was a statement in there where he says that science has nothing to say about religion. And this has received a lot of flack from some of the more, I guess we could say, militant atheists among the community online. And it's sort of really interesting to see how it seems like there's this big split, as a lot of people talk, between the atheist skeptics and the skeptics who say that, well, no, science can't actually say anything about religion.
There are a lot of people who are atheist and are very private about it, almost in a libertarian sort of way. I can have my beliefs, you can have your beliefs, and as long as the two never cross. And then there are, and like I say, I would probably put myself in as a document who sees religion as one of the main corrupting features of society. But that being said, I'm being directed by our sound engineer and the other members of our vast staff here at the station.
Yes,
that
you
we
can
need
hear
to
the hubbub.
Do something. Daniel, what is it you're trying to get me to do?
I'm thinking we should play another interview from Ontario.
Good. So essentially you've been cut off.
our roving interviewer, Ethan
Clough.
Okay, so we're here at the CFI National Convention with
Ryan Clark.
Diana Glennie.
And what do you guys do?
Do for work? Or?
Well, I mean, why are you a skeptic at the CFI National Convention?
Oh, I guess interest in science would be the number one reason. Yeah, that's about it.
I'm the acting president for the McMaster Association of Secular Humanists, and I'm here today to network with the other clubs that are here from across Canada.
And how is that going for you right now?
Awesome. I'm sitting here, and I just met a new friend from Concordia.
That's awesome. So what's going on at McMaster's?
McMaster University, it's going pretty good, actually. Our club is very active. We have guest lectures all the time with different professors in different areas, but our next big event is a Pi Day Pi Party. So if anyone's in the area, they can come out on March 15th.
And so what goes on at a Pi Party, exactly?
You eat a heck of a lot of pie.
And so as a skeptic, you must have some event that you're basing this on, some perhaps Francis Bacon had a party and they all ate pie. Is that what you're basing this on?
No, actually, March 14th is the 3.14 day. Unfortunately, it falls on a Sunday this year, so we're going to have our party on the 15th. But we find that a lot of our members are actually being drawn from the maths and the philosophy departments, and so we try to target our events to their interests.
That's awesome. And so how are things going at Concordia?
Much better. We've been struggling to get the club acknowledged for 2 years. It's complicated to get into, but basically we got it 3 weeks ago. So we're officially a club now.
That's awesome. Why were you having trouble getting recognized?
Bureaucracy, basically. The changing of the CSU every year. We were given verbal ascension, but the person never made a recording of it. So we had no proof that we were actually approved. So basically I had to go in and make a case for it, and they agreed.
So what can students at Concordia look forward to from the... What's your club's name, by the way?
The Free Thought and Humanist Club of Concordia.
And what can they look forward to?
It's a good question. I hope they can look forward to some interesting speakers, hopefully from CFI. You know, I'm not sure exactly what we have planned, but Nick and I have to really talk about it. We haven't... Nick Sagos. Have we talked to him yet?
Yes, we did talk to Nick, actually.
Yeah, he's... He's sort of like, it's basically me and Nick right now trying to get everything happening. We were in a weird situation where we didn't have status, so we couldn't recruit. So we only have like 3 members right now, but I hope that's the main goal, is getting some more members.
That's excellent. So suppose someone's listening to this show and they happen to be at Concordia. How can they join your club? How can they get in contact with you?
It's a good question. Right now, they could email me, I guess, because I haven't set up anything yet. I'm trying to figure out the best way to go. Yeah, Facebook. I was going to talk to the McGill group to see if they had one, too, to maybe sort of leash off their successes.
That's pretty good. How about McMaster's?
Well, McMaster Association of Secular Humanists is Googleable. We have a website, but our most active venue is our Facebook group. So anyone's free to join, and you'll get updates as they come.
Okay, well, thanks both of you, and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Me, 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 me.
Oh, that was a nice little nap there. Sorry about that, folks. We were just catching a little cat nap. Apparently, it's good for your health.
Yes, actually, some research out of UC Berkeley says that sleeping several times a day, i.e. napping, helps with memory storage and improves your capacity to learn. They got about 40 people and put them in nap and no-nap conditions and basically had them do a bunch of, like, difficult learning and memory tasks throughout the day, and one of them was told to nap for about an hour and a half in the middle of the day, and one of them didn't get to nap. And they found that napping helps you learn more stuff, basically. It helps you retain more new facts, and no sleep led to worse memory and really bad learning. So basically they found that pulling an all-nighter, as we've all done, leads to a very decreased ability to retain new facts by nearly 40% from the other condition.
And for all those teachers who get really, really upset for students taking a quick little nap in their class, really they should almost encourage it at the right moment so that when they do wake up, they can get the important stuff of the lecture. Not that instructors ever have an unimportant part of the lecture. Every part I know is...
So does this mean it's not just lazy to nap now? There's a good reason to do it?
There is a good reason to nap. Actually, the another cool thing about this research is that for a while, sleep researchers have been looking at this one thing that happens between deep sleep and REM. It's called stage 2 non-REM sleep. We spend half of our regular sleep hours in this stage, and no one really had a good idea of what it does. And they found, like doing some analysis of their data and their EEG data, that the memory refreshing effect happens during this specific phase of sleep.
So how long does your nap have to be before you get into this stage 2 memory refreshing sleep?
Well, the nap condition slept for an hour and a half.
Okay.
That sounds not that long.
Not that long.
You know, it's funny, too, because I always make fun of, I'm sorry, not make fun of, that's not quite the right word, but I laugh behind their back, at people on the bus who I mean, you go into school, you come back from school, you go wherever, and you see people snoozing on there. But that's not enough time for them to really gain anything, and they probably don't get a deep enough sleep?
Probably not. I mean, what sleep phase you enter depends on how sleep-deprived you are. Like, I may be wrong about this, but I believe that if you've been sleep-deprived for a while and then you go to sleep, you enter REM straight away, as opposed to going through the stages beforehand if regular sleep.
Cool. Actually, and I'd heard a study somewhere, too, for these people who stay up all night to study, is that you don't... It takes a long time to get back your sleep debt. It's not like if you have one good night's sleep the next day, that makes up for it. If you've missed 8 hours of sleep in a week, you need to make up that 8 hours at some point along the way, and one good night's sleep doesn't reset your sleeping clock.
Yeah, and I've heard from both Daniel and Ethan that they've been quite sleep deprived during this conference.
Oh yes.
So
I didn't sleep at all Thursday night.
Speaking of sleep deprivation, is there anyone else at the conference that we might hear from who might have also been sleep deprived?
Yes, and he interviewed someone. Here we go.
Hi, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, and...
Daniel, your skeptical economics student.
We're at the CFI conference in Toronto, and we're here with...
Nick Sermon from the Humanist Association of Ottawa.
And how did you get involved with the Humanist Association of Ottawa?
Originally, I got involved with the Ottawa Skeptics just by... I was watching Penn & Teller's show on TV, and I thought, I wonder, is there a skeptics group in Ottawa? So I Googled it, and... After going through, apparently there's been several that they fold every few years. I managed to find one that was still starting up and had members. And I went for a while, and then someone mentioned the Humanist Association of Ottawa was having an event that sounded interesting, so I went, and I've been going ever since. And last year I didn't shout "not me" fast enough at the board meeting, so I got elected to the board, and that's where I am now.
And how has your organization been doing? How have your events been going?
Up until a few months ago, we were getting about 20 to 30 people out for a lecture, and then we moved to a new location and got just shy of 65, and we had about 50 for the last one, and we've just recently started launching our unsermon events, which is basically what we do is we take everyone and we break them into small circles of 5 to 6 people and then just talk about whatever you want, and then at the and then you know after about half an hour or so, we'll rotate everyone to switch everyone to a different circle, a different group, and talk to more people about the same thing or different things or whatever sounds interesting. And we had a good turnout for that one. The first one we had 20 people, which isn't bad for a Sunday morning. And unfortunately, being here, I'm going to miss the second one. But
it's tough. Yeah,
it's a sacrifice I'm willing to make, I think.
So you enjoying the CFI conference?
So far, so good. There's a lot of interesting stuff.
Excellent.
Moving to a little more personal question, what's sort of the biggest skeptical topic that you're interested in? Or maybe like two or something, if that's a hard question.
I don't know. I mean, if I had to pick one down, like, if you could have one skeptical topic just disappear off the face of the planet type thing, I'd have to go to AltMed, just because in general I know some of these people are sincere, but some of them I've seen where you can tell their business plan is just find some sick people and take them for all they're worth, and that to me is a big problem. Anything like that where people are actually being injured, where people are losing their life savings for nothing, stuff like that, the smaller stuff to me, ghosts and stuff, where it's less overtly harmful. I mean, yes, people do get injured, going to places they shouldn't or whatever, but stuff where alternative medicine being a big one, and just scams in general.
Well, that's excellent. So if for our listeners who live in Ottawa and want to get involved, how would they go about becoming a member of the Human Association of Ottawa?
We're on Meetup. I think it's humanistottawa.meetup.com, but off the top of my head, I can't remember. We're also going to be launching a new website at Humanist Ottawa Web, and we just got humanistottawa.com and atheistottawa.com. We're going to be putting those online, too, probably in the next couple weeks. Our meetings, we have them generally third Sunday of the month at the Y on Argyle Street. And same thing, unsermons generally every second Sunday morning, also at the Y on Argyle Street. And that's about it.
Well, Nick, thanks for talking with us, and enjoy the conference.
I will.
And welcome back to Radio Freethinker. So, Daniel, what else happened at the conference? We have a bunch of interviews, but we have you, and you were there, so tell us about
it. I was there. I was a little sleep-deprived, but I was there.
Actually, hold it. Now, can you prove you were there? Is there any archaeological evidence to show that you were actually at this conference? Can you...
nice attempt at a segue, but... I'm sure my DNA ended up on something. Wait, that's okay.
Moving on!
Anyways, the second day of the conference for me was sort of the day where a whole bunch of people came in and presented on different topics relating to science and skepticism. The day started off a little iffy. It turns out there was more or less a pseudo-archaeologist there. I'm not sure how familiar you guys are with the general theory of human creativity and language, that it more or less popped up about 40,000 years ago and then just exploded.
The theory or human creativity and language?
The human creativity, that's the theory. It's the Big Bang of creativity or something. I can't remember the exact
name. Isn't part of it, too, that and I think science is, the archaeological evidence has changed a bit, but we thought that creativity, artistry, was a uniquely human capacity, but now it's being seen that it's Neanderthals were just as creative as we are, and Homo habilis and the other ones.
See, that's what this archaeologist, actually, I don't think he was, I'm not sure what he was, this guy was arguing. He was arguing that as far as 2 million years ago, potentially even more, humans were showing signs of creativity. Just so our viewers can look at his supposed evidence, if you go to originsnet.org, there's a whole bunch of pictures of things that have been brought or have been dug up that apparently show great human creativity.
Can you give us some examples?
Well, there was one from about 2 million years ago, I think, that sort of looks like a face in a rock. But
is that an example of pareidolia?
That's exactly
face
what
on
I
Mars
thought.
Type thing.
When he showed that and started arguing that, like, clearly that was advanced creativity, I was a little skeptical. It with just one thing like that, I think it's almost just as likely that it's an accident, or maybe the, like, prehistoric people, whatever they were back then, I forget, maybe they just happened to find it and they liked it. It looked, because they noticed that it kind of looked like their face and kept it. Not necessarily that they themselves, like, crafted it. And a lot of the other things, I'm just not seeing, like, things that looked like they could have just been two rocks hit together and some flakes came off, and he was saying that they were signs of Gaia mythology. And
okay.
Yeah. Well,
but to be fair, and to pull my butt out of the fire, the things I was talking about, we're talking maybe 50 or 60,000 years ago, and their burials where they found artifacts in the burials. And that's where I was coming from, not the Kurt.
Yeah, like they'll find
chariots of the god sort of example that you seem to be pointing out here.
They find buried human remains with flower petals or like little necklaces or stuff thrown in there with them.
Oh yeah, there was another presenter there, Dr. Christopher DiCarlo, who is a philosopher of from the University of Detroit, I think. He did a talk sort of about that, where he mentioned things like that, where burial methods have been found farther back than about 30,000 years ago. The thing is, what the other pseudo-archaeologist type guy was saying, though, was that 2 million years ago, humans were more or less as creative as they were 30,000 years ago. And if that was true, I just don't see how there wouldn't be more evidence of it, and how we probably would be, like, far out into space by now, because...
Well, I mean, if sort of... This may be a sort of slippery argument, but it makes a certain amount of reasonable sense that if humans were... Or, like, I don't even know if there were, like, actual humans 2 million years ago, but whatever it was, if they were that creative and that prolific at making stuff, there should be a lot more of it.
Exactly.
Well, I'm gonna play devil's advocate here, because we all know that I'm in league with the devil. one of the things you have, and you get this with folk art too, right? I mean, which is a more modern thing, is if a lot of your art is naturalistic, it's taking something in nature, it's like weaving, right? I mean, fabrics don't survive well in archaeology. They just tend to disappear. And if I have a wood carving of something, let's say I did the Mona Lisa in wood, right? I mean, it wouldn't survive today. So a lot of these things may not be around, not because they weren't there, but they just happen to be a material that doesn't preserve very well.
But
The evidence that he did show for 2 million years ago hypothesis, it wasn't very good.
No, I looked a bit through his website, and things to me that he was claiming were great expressions of art looked at most like tools, and very simple, like smashing tools, and I personally just didn't see it. I urge our listeners to check out the originsnet.org website, and you can look for yourself at all the different things he has compiled with other colleagues of his.
There were actually a couple of other stories in paleontology that I heard about this week, or at least recently. There was a story I remember that is actually almost completely directly related to this. I don't know if you can look it up in your laptop now while I'm trying to remember what it was, but basically they found markings on ostrich eggs at a dig site somewhere. And people are talking about that this is, it's clearly early art, but they're still debating whether it had any significance or not. And also people are talking about whether it may have been an example of early writing or not. Now that one is far more... closer to pseudo-archaeology than saying that it's decorative.
Well, and those ostrich eggs, looking at the article that we've with the wonders of the interweb.
Yes, we just dug it up here. This 60, is from BBC 60, News. Years. Inscribed ostrich shell fragments found in South Africa are among the earliest examples of the use of symbolism by modern humans, scientists say. And they've been dated to about 60,000 years ago.
Oh, yes. This reminds me of another thing he brought up, arguing that there was some sort of secret code, he has decoded, but no one else has yet decoded, stretching back millions of years. That is where it kind of went off from just a little iffy to, no.
Although, okay, so this guy, who we haven't named yet,
yes,
is crazy. But he brings up some very interesting points. I mean, one, when was the first art? And let's pretend
that we have a completely solid definition of art, first of all.
that's exactly where I was going to go with this. I mean, once we started making stone tools and stuff like that, then the possibility that I make a stone tool in an artistic manner, and because it's so removed from our present day, what the heck does that mean? Right? I mean, if you go, if we look back at the Greeks or whatever, right? I mean, they had shields and they had spears, and those were functional, but they also had them as very decorative items, and maybe for that period of time, that's true.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least it's good that he's asking the questions. But again, there's a point where asking a question is good. Saying, "Hey, what is art? When did it really begin?" Great. Sitting there saying, "I've decoded a secret message from millions of years ago," is pushing your luck.
Yes. We're going to go on to the last of Ethan's interviews, and we will be back in about 5 minutes.
So we're here at the CFI National Conference, and I'm talking with
Greg Oliver from the Canadian Secular Alliance. I'm the vice president.
So what is the Canadian Secular Alliance?
Essentially, we are a nonprofit organization that is dedicated towards the goal of church-state separation and government neutrality in matters of religion.
So a political activist force, basically.
Exactly.
So I'm sure that lots of our listeners would love to get involved with this. What would be the first step for learning about the Canadian Secular Alliance?
Well, I think the first thing you can do would go to our website, www.secularalliance.ca. On that website, there's instructions for getting involved. You can donate, and all of our policies are there. So there's an awful lot of good reading material on there that pretty much describes what we're all about and what our policy objectives are.
So maybe you could just give us, like, what right now are the top, like, maybe top three things you guys are working on, like maybe the top three projects?
Well, I'd say probably the main substantive issues are, one, getting rid of the funding for religious school boards that currently exists on a full basis in Ontario, Alberta, and Saskatchewan, and then a partial basis in most of the other provinces. Another thing that's really big is advancement for religion is a qualification for charitable status. This is something that costs the Canadian taxpayer approximately $1.5 billion a year. And it's explicitly for the purpose of promoting religion. It's if a secular equivalent organization opened with the intent of promoting morals and ethics, they wouldn't get charitable status. So we feel this is really unfair wealth transfer from the non-religious to the religious, and it's something that has got to be eliminated. And then another major issue is the free speech thing, human rights commissions, that sort of thing, of occasionally censored people who wanted to express religious views. The Ezra Levant and Mark Stein cases are obviously well-known examples of that. And we also touch on a variety of symbolic issues, things of that nature. There's exemptions for religious people in law, which we feel that one law should apply equally to all citizens. So there's a variety of issues like that.
I take it the Canadian Secular Alliance has an opinion on the recently opened and then closed anthem issue. What was the primary concern for you guys?
Well, it's simply a matter of inclusiveness. We would like to see the word God removed from the English version of the anthem,
and we would like to see the two phrases in the French anthem that explicitly refer to the Christian faith removed from the anthem because, well, right now we have a situation in Canada where 23% of the population is not religious, and we don't think it's... we think this is, the anthem is something, although it's just symbolic, it doesn't have a major impact on our day-to-day life, it's something that Canadians should be proud of, and it's something that all citizens should care about equally.
And you mentioned that there's a sizable percentage of non-religious. That could actually be more because you guys are also looking at the census and rewording the question, which could indicate that there are actually more non-religious people.
Well, first of all, they only take the census every 10 years, right? In 1991, I believe it was around 12%, and I think it was 16.3 in 2001. Since 2001, a lot's happened with the atheist movement. There's been the new atheists, and it's really got become a much more vocal and visible group in Canadian society. So I think that that number is likely going to be a lot higher. But the major problem with the census is the question's loaded. It invites people to pick a religion even if they're not a practicing member of that religion. So it's a way of... It distorts the true reality of religious belief.
Yeah, and I imagine that most of our listeners would probably agree with you on that one. I guess just maybe wrapping up, what did you think of the CFI conference here? What are your thoughts on it?
Oh, I thought it was great. Got to meet a lot of people, got to hear a lot of interesting speakers. Definitely a worthwhile experience.
Well, excellent. And thanks for talking with us on Radio Free Thinker.
Oh, no problem. Anytime.
And we're back. Ha, stole it from you, Rob.
I'll get you for this.
Actually, it's funny because they were talking about, you know, God and references that in the Canadian National Anthem. And a lot of people don't realize this. In fact, a member of the NDP Party quit in the Constitutional Foundation things. In the Canadian Constitution, in the very first part, the preamble to it, it says that Canada is founded upon the principles of the recognition of the supremacy of God and the rule of law, noting God comes before law. And again, as an atheist, I find that disturbing. and it just, I don't know, it seems like a very anachronistic thing to have.
Although, I mean, I'd say that Canada is more progressive as regards neutrality with regards to religion than the States, which has a constitution that explicitly separates state and church.
Yeah, it comes down to a cultural thing. And even though legally the U.S. should probably be the most separate between church and state of, like, any country in the world, culturally, they're so Christian, generally, that...
It's the real politic of,
yeah,
you know...
Laws, constitutions can only do so much.
Actually, on the subject of changing the Canadian National Anthem, I heard a story recently that there was a group in Montreal, I think, that were trying to change the line, "In All Thy Sons Command." They were a feminist group that wanted to get rid of the sons and replace it with something gender neutral.
I guess you didn't hear the news. In the throne speech, almost exactly a week ago on Wednesday, Stephen Harper, through the Governor General, basically said that they were going to look into that, changing sons to something gender neutral. By Friday, though, when we were at the CFI conference, this had all fallen apart. And basically he backed off, said Canadians are strongly against this. And
well, and of course, to be cynical here, and this is cynical, a lot of people figure Harper did this along with another element of his foreign aid policy favoring women. Is, we may not know this, but we have a minority government right now, and the current politicians don't like that, and they're desperate to try to get votes somewhere. And this,
unfortunately,
is
Parliament has been prorogued.
Yeah, but so
that's
so
a show topic for a different show.
Cynical people say that this idea of changing the national anthem was just a cheap political grab for votes, and obviously it wasn't a good one, and not that Harper's the only one ever to do this, so I'm not trying to kick on him that much.
If you look at it, though, there wasn't really any strong voter backlash against Harper for bringing this up. People just wanted to say that, look, we'd prefer if you didn't. So he sort of gained some votes for being willing to stand up for, like, gender neutrality and get some female votes that way. But at the same time, I don't think this really hurt him with anyone else. It was a well-played political move. I'll give him that.
Well, the At Issue People, which is a political show on NBC, CBC, they actually didn't. They kind of kicked them for it. But you're right. The average people probably go eh. But speaking of separation of church and state, I'm in the blogosphere. I was listening to the New York Times science podcast, and they were talking about a new movement in the States, again, trying to get creation and intelligent design into the classrooms. And
haven't they been smacked down enough times in court?
Well, you know, it's funny. They're using the old, well, not bait and switch, but if you put enough crap around it, camouflage. They're camouflaging it in such a good way. The language, there was a bill in Kentucky that's been introduced that uses the term, and I quote here, the advantage, teachers are encouraged to discuss the advantages and disadvantages of scientific theories, including evolution, the origin of life, global warming, and human cloning.
Well, this is the old teach the controversy idea, except this time it looks like they're putting it beside some other controversial topics.
Well, and apparently the idea of it is every time they've done this bugaboo before, it's been evolution and creation, or evolution and intelligent design, and that goes right against the separation of church and state. But this time, they're bringing in origin of life, human cloning, climate change, things where there's a bit more of a debate on. And it fuzzes the issue, because now you can't say, well, climate change isn't a separation of church and state issue, right? It might be ration versus irrational, but that's a whole
unless other. You know, there's people talking about like flood theories of climate change.
Yeah, that's or the those people who actually like climate change and they're looking forward to the end of the human race because they see it's Armageddon. Christ will soon walk the earth once we screw up the planet. But I just
that
I just,
seems perfectly reasonable.
Well, no, actually, I heard about this one group of religious people who are in Lebanon planting cedars. Because according to biblical philosophy, Christ can't come back until there are cedars in Lebanon, and I guess most of them are cut down at some point. So they're planting cedars, hoping for the end of times. And you get there's just to share the wealth. The president of Iran, whose name I won't even attempt to pronounce, is supposed
Ahmadinejad.
To be, thank you. It's supposed to be a member of one of these apocalyptic things, except of course it's Muhammad or Allah as opposed to Jesus. But again, you know, the sooner we can bring the end of the planet, the better. And it's scary things. In fact, we were having a discussion just before we came on air about airline security. And Daniel was telling me how silly he thought it was. And I guess I'm going to have to agree, it is kind of silly. You know, they pat down all the passengers before they go on the plane because, you know, they might have an Uzi or some form of explosive. And then they pat down babies and children, right? And I mean, obviously, babies or children are not going to do terrorist acts in and of themselves. And I think in one sense, once you buy into this idea that, you know, if you're going to do it, you could hide something in there hoping they don't find it. But Daniel, what did you say when I mentioned that?
What did I say? People probably aren't going to kill their own children for a, like, secondary thing. I mean, people sometimes go crazy and kill their own children, but I don't think someone is going to use their baby to smuggle explosives to blow up a plane.
And, you know, if it was like, you know, a communist or an anarchist or something, I think I might agree with you. But I think it underestimates religious fanaticism. I think there are a number of people who say, well, you know, if they die, they're going to go to heaven, right? I mean, how much better is that than anything else? And it's not suicide or whatever, or they're doing it for martyr cause. So I don't know. I mean, I think, although I think the pat-downs in general are somewhat silly because you've got the scanners that go through. And if someone's going to
sneak
a bomb
as we've talked about on, you know, on previous episodes of the show, you know, security scanners, pat-downs, screening, all that stuff doesn't actually work very well.
No.
But, if you want to find those episodes that I just mentioned, you can listen to our archives on RadioFreeThinker.com. And if you have any questions or comments or concerns about the show, you can email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
And I don't know about anyone else here, but we're almost at the end of the show, so I'm going to bring up a skeptic highlight. A show, actually, a British show that me and Rob watch and learn such fascinating facts and prove how quite ignorant we are.
You may have heard of the show. It's hosted by someone named Stephen Fry, I think.
The most Twittered person in the world, isn't he, or something like that?
I mean, yes, he's quite a twat. But, of course, we're talking about QI.
Yeah, QI, which is the BBC has a series of game shows that aren't really game shows. They have a pack of comedians who go on. There are other dignitaries. QI is one of them. Have I Got News for You? Mock the Week. And I think Nevermind the Buzzcocks, which is a sports one, but the QI, it's really good. You know, every year they have a theme word. Every show they have a theme word. This week was Greek, and I learned all sorts of things about the Olympics, which I won't share with you today, but maybe in a future episode. So you can either download them through torrents. If you happen to be in England, BBC has a very good broadcasting thing, although they're very religious about not letting anyone non-British do it, but you can find QI out there on the interweb, and I'd recommend watching it. They're in their sixth season. It's quite an entertaining and educational show.
I'd just like to remind everyone that Skepticamp Vancouver is coming up on March 20th. You can go to Vancouver Skepticamp's website. I think it's vancouver.skepticamp.com or something like that.
If not, Google it.
Yeah, Google it. Register for it.
It'll be on our website, too.
Come see us talk for a couple of minutes.
See us talk? What? What? Are we going to be on there? Are we going to... Wow.
Do I have to think of something to say?
No, you don't, because we can play one more time the thank you reel of all the people that donated to CITR during our show.
And so just to close out on that, this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Rob saying have a good evening.
This is Daniel saying thanks for listening.
Thank you to the following 2009 CITR Fund Drive donors who donated during Radio Free Thinkers. Thank you Paula, Gordon, Fred, Elon, Rob, Ryan, Marlene, and Louise.
Want to know how to choose the right courses for your program? Want to learn more about majors, minors, honors, and professional programs? Are you looking for information about co-op, exchange, or careers? This is how we do it. The Imagine Your Arts Major Fair is a one-stop shop where professors, advisors,